I'm going to speak very quietly because Dominic's got a sore head. This is the Europeans. It's a quite good podcast about Europe.
Everyone's going to now think I'm just hungover.
You're not, though. You've got concussion. Or you did. What happened?
It was very mild and I'm really okay. I just banged my head on my new house. We've got lots of low beams.
Oh.
And I thwacked it really hard and then felt a bit funny for a few days. But it's nothing serious. No need to worry, listeners.
I can't think of anything worse than having concussion and living next to a massive bell tower, which dongs every 15 minutes. I hope you've got a nice big stock of like ibuprofen next to you.
You're not meant to take ibuprofen when you have concussion, actually. Risk of bleeding.
Now I know.
Please don't give bad medical advice on the podcast, Katie. We cannot be held liable for anything.
What are you supposed to have instead?
Oh, you're meant to have paracetamol. Anyway, how was your week?
Much less dramatic. I have been teaching English at a Paris journalism school, which I do from time to time. And it was quite fun. And my students were very well behaved. But I'm really glad that it's not my full-time job. Teaching is exhausting. Have you ever taught anything?
No, I once taught one singing lesson and I found it really hard work. I don't know how people do it.
Yeah, me neither. I have nothing but admiration for the teachers out there. Which brings us very neatly onto this week's guest, actually. She is a teacher living in France, Juliette Percher. She's a middle school teacher in Grigny, which is one of the poorest towns in France. I actually met her while doing some reporting out there. And she's kind of a generally awesome person. The kids that she teaches grow up in pretty tough circumstances, and she really wants to see them doing well. Is France offering these kids the best education that it can, given the limited resources? Juliette wasn't so sure. So she crowdfunded a journey around the world to visit schools in 18 countries that are trying to do things a little bit differently. And the results are pretty interesting. So we're going to hear from her in a bit.
But first, we need to have our new anniversary segment. I actually think we need to decide what to call it. Is it like Centenary Corner or... No, it's not always a centenary, so...
Anniversary Corner.
Anniversary Corner doesn't have the same ring. Anniversary Allotment?
Yeah, listeners, please write in with some suggestions for better names because clearly we need your help on this one.
So first we have Black Friday. Does that count?
No.
No, okay. Sorry, I'm kidding. I have to say I didn't find much. But it is the 85th birthday of the great Polish composer Penderecki. That's something.
That's very nice. Happy birthday, Penderecki.
I feel like I'm really failing at this segment this week, but it is not going to die a death too quickly, at least not for another week, because next week we have a very big anniversary. Our own.
Da, 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 da.
Can you believe that? We've been doing this for a year, Katie.
I can't believe it. It's gone so fast.
What are we going to do to celebrate?
I think people should send us some birthday messages. That would be nice.
That is a really nice idea.
Is that a bit vain? Being like, yeah. Wish us happy birthday.
No, I like that. Also, Katie and I were talking. We were saying we think we should interview someone really famous. Someone like Conchita Wurst. Or...
I love how that's like your first example. I love Conchita too, but quite a random example of like...
Well, someone really famous and European.
And interesting. And cool.
And interesting. So if you've got any ideas of people we should interview for our very special anniversary week, then let us know. Also, if you've got any contacts to Conchita Wurst or anyone of a similar status, that would be perfect because we'd like to get a really big name.
Put us in touch with your famous friends. Can I go first? Because despite mine being good week, it's somehow not as fun, even though it is really important.
Sure, go for it.
Yeah, it's been a good week for Polish judges. This year, the right-wing government of Poland, which has come in for a lot of criticism from its neighbours in Europe for doing stuff that looks more than a little undemocratic, that government earlier this year brought in a new law which lowered the retirement age for judges from 70 to 65, which is very thoughtful, you might think. Give those judges more time to enjoy doing the gardening in their retirement. The thing is that lowering the retirement age had the convenient effect of forcing out like a third of the judges on the Supreme Court, which, coming at a time when the Polish government is in general trying to take over the court system, was more than a little worrying.
Yeah.
These court reforms have triggered some really big street protests over the last couple of years by Polish people who really do like democratic checks and balances. And it also triggered a massive power struggle with the EU. Brussels has basically been like, what are you doing? That's not how we do democracy in Europe. We like judges that are independent from the government. And last year, to put Poland under pressure over all of this, the EU triggered this thing called Article 7 for the first time ever.
I like the idea that that is like the equivalent of the EU saying, what are you doing? Article 7, aka the what are you doing trigger.
I should have one of those for you when you behave badly.
Hey!
Pull my Article 7 trigger at you.
I'm concussed.
He's hungover. He's had a wine again.
Stop it.
He's concussed, everyone. I'm very sorry. Anyway, yeah, Article 7. In theory, could mean Poland losing its voting rights in the EU, although no one thinks that would actually ever happen. The EU took this issue to its court, the European Court of Justice, which ruled last month, yep, you've got to reinstate these judges. The good news is that this week Poland did that. All of the judges got their jobs back, partly because the Polish government would have been fined loads of money if they just ignored the court ruling. So this is good news in the immediate term. But, and I don't want to be a Debbie Downer here, but I do think the longer term picture is not quite as cheery, because this judge thing was part of a whole bunch of changes that Poland has made to the court system, which are still quite worrying. Like, for example, the PIS, the ruling party, now controls the body that nominates all judges.
Oh, it sounds like America.
Yeah, it does a bit. We were having this conversation the other day, and I actually Googled yesterday, like, why does the American president even have that power? And there was this legal expert from Yale saying that nobody could really agree on why the president was given that power. And I'm not sure it's the best idea.
No, I'm not sure it is either. I was just wondering, do you think some of the judges are like really bummed that they have to go back to work having thought they were going to get early retirement?
They wouldn't be very good public-minded judges if they were. A lot of them were like super pissed off, including the head of the court, who I think had actually refused flatly to step down.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, if you're looking for a country in Europe that's looking a little on the authoritarian side, quite a worrying way, I would say Poland is quite a good place to start, along with Hungary. How's that for good week?
Great, really good.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay, time for bad week.
Which is perversely kind of happier in a weird way.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's at least juicy. Mm. It may in fact be the juiciest bad week story we've ever had.
Ooh.
You may have already seen a story about a stolen Picasso painting passing through your feeds of your social media. I mean, not literally the painting passing through your feeds, but the story. And if you didn't look into it in detail, or if it's totally passed you by, then you are very lucky that I'm here to tell you this wonderful twisting tale.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start back in 2012, when there was one of the biggest art heists that Europe has ever seen. The Kunsthal Museum in Rotterdam had just started displaying some paintings from the collection of Dutch investor Willem Cordier, when only one week in, seven of them went missing overnight. One of them was the Tête d'Arlequin by a little-known artist we call Pablo Picasso.
That guy.
Yeah, heard of him. Four Romanian men were convicted of the theft 1 year later. I said theft.
The theft.
Theft 1 year later, but the artworks themselves were never recovered. There was a suggestion from the mother of one of the convicted that she had burned them in order to protect her child, which is pretty gruesome.
Jesus.
She then rode back that comment in front of the judges, but who knows? The mystery of the missing paintings continued to fascinate people, and one Dutch-Romanian author wrote a book about the heist. Mira Feticiu is her name. Things started getting weird when Mira was sent an anonymous letter telling her that one of the missing paintings, the aforementioned Picasso, was hiding under a rock.
It was hiding, personally.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, don't find me.
Yes, exactly. It's the head of Harlequin. He was hiding under a rock.
Okay.
Not far from the... Don't be so snarky, Katie.
It's my job.
Not far from the village of Karchaliu, the village where the convicted robbers had lived. So Mira passed on the letter to the relevant authorities, didn't hear back, and thought, okay, I'm going to take this into my own hands. I'm going to make a trip. And she took along her colleague, Frank. They followed the detailed directions to find this rock. And after passing through all the complicated steps in the directions, they found the rock. And underneath it was a painting covered in plastic. As they lifted it up, they saw that it wasn't just any painting. It was indeed a painting depicting the head of the Harlequin. Mira couldn't believe it and was overcome with emotion. She passed it on to the Romanian authorities with the help of the Dutch consulate, and then everything got even weirder. Very soon it emerged that the painting was a fake.
What?
And not only that, but the painting had been planted by a Belgian performance art company called Berlin. Now, can I just interrupt for a second to say that Berlin is a really rubbish name for a Belgian performance art company. Aside from anything else, it makes it very difficult to Google. Try typing like Berlin performance art.
Oh no.
Yeah, I wasted many minutes trying to find them. Anyway, Berlin posted something on Facebook saying that indeed it was them that had buried this painting, and they had sent the letter to Mira and to some others, apparently, who hadn't followed up the trail. And it was all part of a performance piece about truth and forgery. I did eventually find their website, and I won't tell you what it is because I think after pranking Mira, they at least deserve the dark fate of having an unfindable website. But they claim that the prank is part of a performance about the Dutch master forger Geert Jan Jansen. The performance revolves around the life of a forger and the inherent question of the value of truth. I must say that, like, I feel a bit morally conflicted about this one. I wouldn't have done this prank myself, and I find it difficult to see through the victims of Frank and Mira, who Mira is apparently reportedly quite upset. Who made an unnecessary trip to Romania. But I also think it's quite an amazingly ambitious piece of performance art, and nobody was hurt.
Well, this is the thing. Is it a piece of performance art, or is it a publicity stunt? The cynic inside me is thinking, this has made loads more people aware of this theatre company. And in the process, this poor writer has made this unnecessary trip to Romania. She should at least get the money for the plane tickets back.
I mean, yeah, she should. That's true. But I don't know if I buy the argument that it is just a publicity stunt. I mean, performance art often does get publicity when it's shocking like this, yes. And maybe that was part of it. And I did see that on their Twitter account, they had tweeted about it with the articles from the New York Times and the Guardian and stuff. But it had zero retweets and zero likes. They're only followed by like 150 people on Twitter. And I kind of think it's an interesting experiment. Anyway, they were hoping that the painting would actually be believed as a real painting and would be brought in to a gallery and presented as the real thing. So, and the fact that actually the news media did report on it as a real painting for at least 24 hours, people thought that it was real.
Yeah. The article I saw was like, you know, apparent Picasso found under tree. And like, I hadn't seen anything at that point following up the fact that it was actually a big hoax.
I mean, that is part of the prank, that they're trying to hoax the media. And therefore, yes, it gets publicity. But I don't think that it should be totally written off simply because it involved the media.
What I think is that we should write the screenplay of this pan-European art drama. That is how we get rich and famous, Dominic.
Yeah, or maybe Mira should, because like she is a writer and she did spend a lot on that flight.
It's her story.
And hiring a car, probably. It's her story. It's yours, Mira. Now, Katie, you wrote about the town of Grigny a few months ago, where Juliet, this teacher who we're about to interview, lives. I was thinking of how to introduce this, and I was looking through your article, and I was actually thinking it was probably better if you introduced this one instead of me just reading out quotes from your article.
You can do that if you want. So I went to Grigny a few months ago because I was writing about the French government's anti-poverty plan. Like, France is, I think, the country in Europe that spends the most on social benefits anywhere in Europe. Yet we have these pockets of really, really grim poverty, like often just on the edges of big cities like Paris and Marseille and places like that. And Grigny is, one example. It's housing estates have quite a lot of the problems that go with poverty. So drugs, crime, there's a lot of slum landlords operating in these housing estates, like cramming loads of immigrants into like really horribly dilapidated apartments. And Juliet teaches in one of its middle schools, this town. She teaches kids aged about 11 to 15. And it's really not easy in her school. To give one grim statistic, only 25% of the kids in this town graduate from high school. It's 80% on average in the rest of the country. So yeah, Juliet really wants to help these kids as best that she can. And she had a sneaking suspicion that the French education system doesn't always allow her to do that. So she set off on a worldwide trip. She crowdfunded it. She visited schools in 18 countries to find out what they're doing and the kind of different approaches that they have to education. And that is what we're going to hear about in a minute.
And you should all check out Katie's article that she wrote about Grigny, because it is actually a very good background.
Oh, that's very
on
kind.
This very interesting and impoverished town. Just 25 kilometers south of Paris.
Yeah, it's really kind of shocking to see this kind of poverty like right on the edge of one of the richest capitals in the world. It's grim stuff. Anyway, let's give Juliet a ring. Hello, Juliet. How are you?
Yeah, very good.
Hi, Juliet. Dominic here. Thank you so much for joining us. I believe you've spoken to Katie before, but I'm really happy you're here.
Thank you.
It feels like a very long time ago that we met. It was warm back then.
Yeah, exactly.
So why don't you start off by telling us how you ended up teaching in Grigny?
So I'm from Bordeaux, and for your first year teaching, you will be in the neighborhood of Paris or maybe in a poor city like Amiens or in the north of France, where no one wants to go.
No one wants to go to Paris?
In not Paris, because it's very hard to get Paris, but in the suburbs of Paris, okay. I would say.
In the banlieue.
Yeah, the banlieue.
Which are kind of internationally notorious, although I don't think it's fair.
Yeah, that's true. I remember in 2015 when we had those riots in the suburbs of Paris, where I remember how it was in the international news. So yeah, I guess it's known everywhere.
So you ended up in the suburb of Grigny, which is just south of Paris. Mm-hmm. What were your first days and months like at your school? I think it was quite a shock.
Yeah, it was, because so I chose to come to Grigny because you can ask to not go there, or you can ask to go there because you believe it's your job to go everywhere. And I knew it was going to be hard and probably painful and probably not what I expected teaching to be. So I remember the first month, I really was very shocked by how the children were. They were so left behind. My first year, I taught in another poor suburb. It's in Évry, in a high school. So I came from this high school, quite sensitive to this middle school with a very bad reputation. And my first period just confirmed all the bad reputation Grigny had. And it was very hard. Before the first holidays, we had a kid who's been shot by another kid. Mm. So I was like, wow, where am I?
Yeah.
And I think before Christmas, we had a lockdown. It was a very, very hard first year. I've never been trained for teaching, because in France, it's not like a diploma for which you have to get some internship. The first time I saw students was the first time I was teaching, so it was a bit late. I had no chance before to practice teaching, observe another teacher doing this. And
wow. So it's completely theoretical, all your training.
It's not theoretical, in fact, because it's not at all teaching, because I'm teaching literature. I had 5 years of studying French literature, and that's all.
Okay, so it was academic study of literature.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And is this something that is thought of as a problem in France? The other teachers you work with, do they all think this is a problem? Or do people just say, yeah, this is how it is?
No, I think everyone thinks it's a problem. It's a great pain when you become a teacher and you think you will be a good teacher and you really deeply believe in your job, but you don't have, just can't do it properly because you are not trained. And I mean, you need training.
Presumably you could have spent a year in this difficult school in Grigny and then tried to find a job in an easier neighborhood with kids who aren't living such difficult lives. You didn't do that though, did you?
Yeah, after that year, I was really frustrated because I felt really useless. I really wanted to make some difference because I felt students really needed motivated teachers. I mean, all my colleagues are really motivated. We're very young. We chose to be here, most of us. And the second year was really easier because the children, they knew me, they knew I was going to stay, so it was really different. They weren't testing me like in my first year.
Can you tell us a bit about the background of your kids? Like, what are the kind of problems that they face at home?
So it's one of the poorest cities in France and one of the youngest one also. The parents aren't well educated. I mean, they aren't educated at all. Most of them are coming from the West African countries, and they came here in France maybe 15 years ago. They aren't speaking good French, so they're not talking French to their children. And my kids really don't have enough vocabulary, but it's very, very low.
And I think that the parents often work really long hours as well, so they're not really at home to help with homework and stuff like that.
They are really struggling. And they are doing all the bad jobs. I mean, they're having a lot of commute, and they're not well paid, and they're having very long hours.
You decided you wanted to do something about the difficulty of teaching at this school. Could you tell us a bit about what you did?
I figured out that we had to change our way of teaching because I was really focused on the social and emotional learning. I don't know if you know what it is.
Kind of. Tell us anyway.
Yeah, it's like the how you handle your emotions, how you communicate with others, mm-hmm. how you can set some goals, how you have a good relationship. And it's all these emotional skills that I found really crucial for my students and that they really lacked. I thought at that time that it was so central and so crucial that we need to address this problem before even teaching like French or literature or math. As soon as my students couldn't handle anger or fear or stress, they just couldn't concentrate during 1 hour to listen to a great lesson about, I don't know, grammar lesson or anything. So I really tried for the next years to address this problem and to make them conscious about how they feel, how they can express those emotions, how they can be more autonomous. That was my great challenge.
So ultimately, you decided to go on a little trip. Tell us a bit about that.
It was a little bit the end of my thinking about how we can change education. I felt I wasn't going far enough. So I decided to go. So I started in India and I went to 18 different countries, starting with India, where I spent 1 month, and it was really exciting because I went to a very innovative school. I was looking for how we can develop those social and emotional skills, and I found really amazing schools developing those.
So I think the idea was to find some examples of best practice around the world, mm-hmm. and you spent a long time looking around different parts of the world for these examples. I was wondering, could you give us just one example that you found that you are now trying to implement in your school back in Grigny?
I would say that I was very interested by the Finnish educational system because it is a very good balance between great respect for children. They don't have detention, they don't have suspension, they don't have any of this. I would say that the character of each student is really took into account, mm-hmm. and they're trying really hard to develop their independence and their self-determination. So this is a great point. But on the other side, they are really challenging in their curriculum. And that is a little bit what I'm trying to set up in place in my, with my students now.
Did you see some things on your journey, Juliette, that made you think, actually how we do it in France is better than this? Like, this is kind of a crazy approach.
I'd love it if the answer to that was just no.
I mean, I felt that I would say no. But in the end, I would say that maybe we have this in France that is a good thing also, is that we take a lot of time. It's a bad thing on many points. We are thinking too much before implementing anything. But on the other side, it prevents us from making really big mistakes, I would say. For example, in the US, they're trying very hard to have this school choice so that the parents can choose where they send their children to. It's creating a lot of segregation. And I would say that our educational system in France, I mean, it's more equal. I was really struck by this.
You did the research partly for yourself and for your own school, but you are also sharing the research online for other teachers. I know we have some teacher listeners, including my sister. So I was wondering, where could they find it?
So they can find it typing www.storiesofinspiringteachers.com.
Great. You made little short videos, didn't you, with lots of the teachers you met around the world where they talk about different methods of teaching and practices. I think that's an amazing resource to have online.
Thank you.
It's funny, you know, I've been teaching this week, as mentioned, and teaching French 18 and 19 year olds, it's really obvious how different the approach is in France to how it is in maybe like a country like the UK where we grew up. They're really smart kids, but they're really used to like rote learning and learning stuff by heart. And they're really not used to teachers asking them their opinions. Like, we have such different approaches around Europe. I find it very interesting. And I am keen to hear about your experience. Did you leave school full of joy for learning? Or were you just like, I cannot wait until this is over? Send us an email, let us know.
Or was there something particularly great that happened in your part of Europe or America or wherever you are, Australia, that you think Juliet could learn about? Let us know and we will pass them on to her. I don't know if she's interested. She's probably got enough ideas. But I'm interested.
I can hear your bells.
Lucky you. I can always hear the bloody bells. Have you ever done any metal detecting, Katie?
Not personally, no.
Oh, okay. Well, neither have I, although I was once in an opera with a metal detector. Does that count? They are very musical.
Why was that? What? It was used as an instrument?
It was used as a kind of prop on stage, but it was also used at the beginning of the opera, and the noise of it was the first music that we heard. The kind of beep, beep.
Ah.
Oh. That's the noise it made when it found something. Anyway, so there's been a steady increase in metal detecting in Wales over the last years. And now here's a statistic that might make you lean in. 90% of artefacts found in Wales are in fact found by metal detectorists, as opposed to like professional archaeologist people.
Ah, I am leaning in.
Yeah, good. Well, you may hope to find a few coins or even a bronze spearhead if you're lucky. But one guy, Mike Smith, was even luckier. He was strolling around with his metal detector in South Pembrokeshire and discovered that his normal stomping ground was waterlogged. So he had to try a different area from normal. And the machine soon did its special musical thing. Little did he know, he was about to be the first person in Wales to discover what is probably a Celtic chariot burial. Ooh. What is a Celtic chariot burial? They are tombs in which very important people, people like you and me, Katie, were buried together with their chariot and often their horses and other possessions.
Wow.
It would be like you or I being buried with our trusty bikes, our iPhones and our podcasting mics.
Oh God, that's so depressing. Yeah. No offense.
This is a very significant discovery and requires a lot of careful excavation. So the archaeologists are not releasing the location at the moment to stop the site from being overrun. Kind of similar to that story in Sweden a few months ago when the girl pulled the sword out of the lake.
Yeah.
There is also a suggestion that this may just be the tip of the iceberg, or rather the tip of an until now unknown Iron Age settlement nearby.
Ooh.
Also like that Swedish girl who pulled the sword out of the lake, Mike needed to convince some skeptics that he'd actually discovered something special. He apparently identified it himself as a chariot burial. Clever guy, Mike, because he'd read about them. But some experts were like, no, they don't exist in this part of the country, because they thought they didn't. Anyway, a trial excavation has already taken place and they think they can see chariot wheels and perhaps the outline of this aforementioned settlement. It's the second time in this podcast I've said the word aforementioned. I should probably stop using it.
You are so pretentious.
Thank you. Also, they think that there might be weapons or treasure under the chariot. It's all so exciting.
Love a bit of treasure.
So congratulations to Mike. I think under Welsh and English and Scottish law, he has to turn it all over to the coroner. But I believe that if they sell any of the treasure, if there is treasure, he can take 50% of the earnings.
Whoa.
With the other 50% going to the landowner. So Mike could become rich, but it's not about the money, is it?
He could afford his own chariot burial one day.
He could, if that's what he decides to spend his money on, then good for you, Mike.
Maybe they should bring that back as a tradition for like famous Welsh people, like Tom Jones or Charlotte Church.
Can we not talk about Tom Jones and Charlotte Church dying?
They're not very much alive, which I'm very glad about.
I love Charlotte Church. That's a secret.
It's not a secret. I'm going to publish this on the podcast.
Oh.
I carried out my favourite European activity this week, aka taking the bus to IKEA.
I knew you were going to say that.
It's what I do. So I had time to listen to a lot of podcasts on the way there and back. And I just wanted to suggest two other podcasts, dear listeners, as a kind of public service announcement. I mean, obviously, if you're bored, you should just go through our previous episodes because they're amazing. Once you're done with those, might I suggest Stammtisch, the podcast about Germany, which has been really good the last few weeks and has just taught me loads of stuff about Germany.
I love Stammtisch. I listened to it all the time when I was in Berlin.
It's wonderful. And also an episode of Radiolab a couple of weeks back called Tweak the Vote, which is about voting systems in Ireland, among other places. It's just way good and gave me a bit of restored faith in democracy.
Oh, cool. That sounds interesting. I'll listen to that one. Thanks for the tips, Katie.
You're welcome.
And we're serious where we really do want you to get in touch if you have any like genius ideas for what we should do on our anniversary. Or if you just want to send us like a message, voice memo or whatever, then please do get in touch. Send us an email, europeanspodcast@gmail.com.
Or find us on Twitter @EuropeansPod or Instagram @EuropeansPodcast or on Facebook.
And thank you again to our wonderful one-man jingle factory, Jim Barn, who we haven't thanked for a while.
Sorry, Jim. He's away on a stag do with my boyfriend this weekend. They've been looking for hedgehogs. Is that a classic stag do thing to do? Bachelor party activity?
That's the best stag do I've ever heard.
Very lovely. They were looking for rare blonde hedgehogs on the island of Alderney in the Channel by the light of the moon.
Oh, that makes me think. I know the UK's leading hedgehog expert. Maybe we should interview him one day. He's really interesting.
We absolutely need to do that. That's our anniversary episode sorted. Hedgehogs next week.
Yes. Why don't we play us out with a little bit of Penderecki? Here's a bit of his first cello concerto written in 1972 and performed by Siegfried Palm and the Polish Radio Symphony Orchestra.
In the meantime, stay away from low ceilings, everyone. Don't bang your head like Dominic. And we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.